Receiving this message. We are Ken Jennings and John Roderick. We speak to you from our present, which we can only assume is your distant past, the turbulent time that was the early 21st century.
Fearing the great cataclysm that will surely befall our civilization, we began this monumental reference of strange and obscure human knowledge. These recordings represent our attempt to compile and preserve wonders and esoterica that would otherwise be lost.
So whether you're listening from an advanced civilization or have just reinvented the technology to decrypt our transmissions, this is our legacy to you.
This is our time capsule. This is the Omnibus. You have accessed entry 173.IS2502, certificate number 34924, the Cahokia Mounds.
Ceremonial mounds in the backyards and towns, that's the way it turned out.
John, would you say you've been to the American bottom?
Mm.
What are your thoughts about the American bottom?
Yes. The American bottom. Well, there are kind of two things, two
buttocks?
Two possibilities, right? You could mean the southernmost parts of America, or you could mean the lowest parts of America.
And oh, in elevation or in moral depravity?
Okay, so that's three different ways. When I think of a bottom, I think of a swamp. So have I been to the swampy parts of America? Yes.
What are you picturing here, like the Okefenokee?
Yeah, sort of Okefenokee, you know, down along the Suwannee River or out in Louisiana, sort of like sinking lands, as they call them,
the old sinking lands.
But I've been to the low parts. I've been to the southern parts. I've been to the swampy parts.
You've been everywhere, man.
Yeah, Boston and St. Clair.
I just came back from America's. They don't call it America's bottom, although that would be funnier.
I've never heard it referred to. But what would you call America's bottom?
The American bottom is actually a geographer's term of art.
Really?
For the floodplain of southern Illinois, like between the Mississippi and the Kaskaskia. Am I saying that right?
So where the Ohio and the Mississippi and all y'all's intersect.
I don't know why it's the. I guess because it's like saying foggy bottom. It's like
right.
It's a term for the low place next to a river
where the fog collects.
And it is swampy there, so you're not wrong. But boy, I how did I not know that southern Illinois is the American bottom?
I didn't know it either, and you know I was just there.
Did you drive through?
We spent the night in Paducah, Kentucky.
Oh, we were not that. I was in Carbondale, Illinois. I was right across the river.
Yeah. So, and in Paducah, we you know, kind of after we dropped the young and old off at the hotel, those of us in the prime of middle age got in the truck and drove around, gave ourselves a little tour of the whole environment. And then driving the next day, we went through Cairo.
Don't they say something weird?
Cairo?
It's not Cairo.
Cairo?
Or something?
I don't know. I didn't stop and ask anybody how they pronounce the name of their town.
I feel like every time this happens, we get people mad. It's Madrid. It's Lisbon. It's Cairo.
Right. Well, let's say Mound City. I went to Southern Mound City. They can't possibly say Mound City is pronounced Mound City. And actually there that you can see the confluence of the rivers, and it's kind of a sight, you know, a pretty exciting place.
Am I remembering wrong? Did your mom have a theory that America's bottom in the sense of America's rectum was actually somewhere in
Butte, Montana. Oh, Butte, Montana. Yeah, that was, she said that's where you would put it in an enema.
Or a thermometer. If you wanted to know
in Butte. How much COVID there was in Montana.
But you know, I love Butte, so I won't disparage it. I stick up for Butte every time. So, you know, that's just mom's theory. And she was in Butte in the '50s. So times have changed.
Butte is you know, Montana's lovely.
Yeah.
But the, you know, this part of the American bottom in I flew into St. Louis and then had to drive a couple hours really just through corn and nothing.
Sure.
Corn and trees and nothing.
The closer you get to the river, the more Mark Twain-y it is.
It's very lush. It's, you know, I just kind of wandered out of my Holiday Inn once I got to the place where I was going and just wandered through a field full of reeds, and there was like a big pond across from somebody's pasture.
Right.
You drive along and your GPS shows you just endless weird shaped lakes. Like it must be doing
Oh, it's where the river used to be.
I guess.
Right. The river and all of its snaking left these vestigial lakes behind.
I guess, but that can't be all of what it is. Like the area is just dotted with ponds. It looks like the Yukon or something. It's, there must be some recognition, you know, automatic processing that gets done of these aerial photos. And, you know, can you drive along and you see just these endless little curves of lake or brook or ex-brook or whatever it is that you're driving through. And I guess that's the wet, damp, fertile, swampy character of America, the American bottom. The American bottom is fertile, apparently.
Well, you know, as we were driving west from Paducah to, I guess, New Mexico, we really experienced the gradual incline that goes from the Mississippi River, where America is, you know, the elevation is measured in tens and maybe hundreds of feet, to New Mexico, and it appears to be flat travel.
Or negative, by the way, if you're in the old sinking lands of the Big Easy.
Right, down underneath. Down underneath where the devil lives.
You believe the devil lives in Lake Pontchartrain?
Well, I believe...
Do they have a Nessie-like creature, but it's a devil?
Having seen that movie with Lisa Bonet in the
Angel Heart.
Yeah, the late 80s.
You're talking about Angel Heart.
I am talking about Angel Heart. The great American film, Angel Heart.
It really turned a whole generation of Americans against the South in maybe a possibly racist way.
It was like...
They're just doing too much voodoo down there. I can't spend any time there. There's all the voodoo.
A lot of sexy chicken beheadings.
Sexy voodoo.
Yeah, sexy voodoo. But no, you can leave the Midwest and head into the Mountain West and feel like you're just driving on a flat plane the whole time. But then you check your altimeter, as one does, and all of a sudden you're at 8,000 feet. And you're like, we went up 8,000 feet and it never...
Did you turn off the fasten seatbelt sign?
I said, you're now, everybody can smoke as long as you're in the back half of the airplane. You're
free to move about the expedition.
It was, it's always impressive, right? To see how much the continental United States are really a giant basin that all collects at the Mississippi.
But they don't call it the American top. They don't call the continental divide.
The American top.
The American top. They didn't get the memo from Southern Illinois.
They say Grand Tetons, right? So it's like the big boobs.
I see. So then where's the navel? It must be about halfway in between Wyoming and Illinois.
It's Omaha. The navel is Omaha.
In the mid-1700s, some French monks traveling up and down the Mississippi saw something that Marquette and Joliet had missed when they were, you know, the first Europeans to take that trip.
These are the voyageurs.
Les voyageurs.
No, but I guess they're monks and not trappers.
And they're voyageurs, not voyeurs. They weren't very observant.
No.
Because what they missed was a giant 100-foot mound not far from the river. And in fact, a network of well over 100, somewhere between 100 and 170, 120, 170 similar mounds of various shapes and sizes, ridges and other seeming earthworks.
Did they miss them because they just looked like hills?
They do look a lot like hills. The funny thing about these mounds is that they were, you know, Americans were fascinated with them for centuries. When I say Americans, I mean not the real Americans. I mean the colonists who came later and
you and me.
Yeah, you and me basically. Yeah. We showed up and
our
moms
and dads.
We were like, "Whoa, what's up with this stuff?"
Yeah. Cool mound, bro. In,
until as late as 1921, there was no archaeological consensus on whether these mounds were man-made or not.
Really?
Yeah.
They didn't have characteristics of something that had been made by men, like for instance, regular curves?
There was no. Yeah, I think in the case of the French monks who spotted this immediately saw it as, you know, it's a weird kind of terraced, raised, you know, pyramid-like thing towering above the river and that part of southern Illinois. And they were like, oh, this is perfect. We'll build a chapel here to our God.
And by towering, how much do they tower?
I mean, 100 feet.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So, and I think the question is, well, you know, if this is, this does seem to be very regular, but how on earth would it have got here?
Yeah.
You know, just to finish the story about the monks, they built a trading post there. And then briefly at the beginning of the 19th century, some Trappists, more monks, got right there and decided the terraces would be perfect for gardening. And so they did.
Brewed some raspberry beer.
And if, is that what the Trappists are often doing?
That's what that's my feeling about them. Always, it's always probably raspberry beer with those guys.
So like they've tried normal beer.
Mm-hmm.
But they're like, we live a life apart.
Let's brew this beer up a little.
That's what God wants?
It's what I wanted when I was drinking raspberry beer.
But the Trappists should surely be doing the divine will. They're imagining that, you know, they live a life apart from our regular non-fruity beers.
Who can say what God inspires?
He invented the raspberry.
There it is.
Why would he not want it in his followers' beer?
He wanted beer, clearly.
Why did he? There's no evidence that he wanted beer.
If he didn't want beer, he could have stopped it at any time.
He could have not created hops.
Think about all the things.
He could have sent another flood the second the Egyptians are about to invent beer. Like, this bread I left out is tasting weird. Suddenly the Nile is like, roo.
This is one of the things we don't discuss about religion is think of all the things that God has prevented.
We don't know.
Well, we know there are no eight-limbed dogs or cats.
But we don't know if there ever were.
Well, there maybe never were because God intervened in advance of that.
In this case, God is the creepy time bureaucrats from the Loki television series.
Yeah.
Who is preventing all the timelines where eight-limbed
That's right.
dogs and cats overran human civilization.
Why don't I have four tongues? Because God did not want it. Why is there beer? Because God did. This is way upstream thinking here.
Yeah, so this is opposite of the problem of evil really troubles people. Why did my neighbor's house burn down? Why was there a genocide in Rwanda? This is the problem of good.
Yeah, this is preempted evil. All of the terrible, terrible, terrible things that could have happened that God didn't want. So the evils that are in the world they're pretty tame.
This really
by
puts
comparison.
Him in a better light.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, that's my feeling about it. Somebody presented an enormous book. How many tongues do we put into people? 6? 16? God was like, nope, 1.
But you don't know if that would have been better.
16 tongues? And what do you get? Boo.
So the word gets out that the these French monks have found an odd series of hills that are weirdly regular. And frontier archaeology begins to study them. And this leads to, you know, a century or more of fascination with what early Americans come to call, and again, by early Americans, I mean
you and me,
our slave owning ancestors, right? Not like
mom and dad,
not like actual early Americans who will come into the story in a moment.
I'm guessing, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Cause somebody was there before the Trappists.
Right.
Spoilers. I just started with them to, you know, as kind of a cunning, what do you call it? Way into the story.
Sure. You're starting halfway through.
It's an entree. It's in medias res.
Yeah. You start at the murder and then work your way back.
So for a century, Americans, you know, scholars, both amateur and professional, become super interested in what they call the mound builders.
Let me ask you, at this stage in Europe, are mounds recognized as Celtic old things?
Yeah, sure. They would have, everybody, you know, it's been well known probably in England, probably since Roman times.
That there
were weird old, you know, for the main reason that they got looted. So people would know, oh, hey, this is the kind of thing you can find in that kind of mound. All the good stuff's probably gone, but,
right.
You know, there's going to be beads and vases and stuff.
Sutton Hoo, still waiting there, and also still waiting on my list of topics for Omnibus.
I just saw the Sutton Hoo stuff in the British Museum not more than a month ago.
Well, let's save it for the show.
No, I actually want to talk about Sutton Hoo now. What if you just commandeer this show and suddenly it's about Sutton
Hoo? Just pivots to Sutton Hoo.
And also that Sutton Hoo movie with Ralph Fiennes.
Yeah.
Did you watch the Sutton
Hoo? Yeah, I did. I watched that.
Sutton Hoo movie or Sutton Hoo V, as I call it?
I watched the Sutton Hoo movie a long time after I added it to the list of possible topics for Omnibus.
But luckily the movie was not good or popular, so you don't have to worry about appearing to be a sellout.
Right. No one else has seen it.
Now that everyone else is like, Sutton Hoo?
I can imagine flipping through Netflix, because I've been doing it recently, and like, there's so much content. What should I watch? And it's like, how about an archaeology movie starring Ralph Fiennes? No, skip on through.
What people might think it's going to be like a Tomb Raider kind of a thing.
Yeah.
Where he does daring feats with a bullwhip. Yeah. Is it?
I mean, they raid a tomb.
There is a tomb and he raids it. Yeah. I guess that's true.
But no, it's a lot more slowly paced.
The interesting thing about, you know, the Midwest is the Americas, as the settlers discovered them, were no less chock full of mounds than many parts of the old country.
Chock full of mounds.
And so the assumption was, well, people built these for the same reason, for some kind of ritual reason.
They buried a Viking ship
for
under
burials.
There.
It's probably like, well, that was exactly what they thought. So, because a lot of the early mound builder discussion is based on the fact that, well, clearly these could not be the noble but primitive red man, as they might have said, that we see declining all around us. That, right. This was a theory at the time that you know, even your enlightened white thinkers in the Americas at this time would have thought, well, the natives here are certainly a noble people, but doomed.
Well, and also didn't exhibit any technology that would indicate an ability to build 100-foot mounds.
That was also the conventional wisdom. You know, none of the Mesoamerican stuff having been discovered yet, it was really like, look, these are Stone Age people. And even once people started to see, you know, temples in the jungles of Mexico and Guatemala, the consensus still was, but in North America here, we just have these Stone Age people, basically, who, you know, wouldn't have even had villages, let alone massive earthworks.
Stone Age is an interesting term, because isn't it possible to be a Stone Age culture and still build a large mound?
With your stone tools.
Yeah. What is the, I mean, do you have to be Iron Age to have, to manage a mound?
It seems like you're suggesting that there might have been some racism and colonialism involved in this judgment and not just scholarly thought, and I think you might be right.
Oh, good. Okay, go on.
Because all the theories are like, well, clearly some Vikings must have come here
right.
and built these amazing mounds, because Vikings, being white folks like ourselves, have the drive and the know-how and the Yankee ingenuity to build big pyramid-like things in the American bottom.
But you would think...
The hemorrhoids of the American bottom, if you will.
If the Vikings had made it all the way to Illinois, that they would have left a little trail of breadcrumbs, right? In the form of...
Little Sutton Hoos everywhere you go?
Yeah, all their weird little temples where they were worshiping boughs of pine.
It wasn't just the Vikings. There were scholars claiming that it must have been the Welsh.
The
Welsh are, that's your people. I mean, they have burial mounds. They're a seafaring people. Clearly, well,
and think about the great civilizations that the Welsh have built around the world.
or even the Hindus. You know, somebody, the idea is somebody somewhere got in a boat.
Yeah.
And, you know, this kind of thinking really flatters the manifest destiny of the early white settlers, because the implication is, look, this land didn't belong to the Native Americans either.
No, it's your land. It's my land.
You know, they took it over from the Welsh, or whoever was here building these mounds 1,000 years ago.
Right.
We took it over from them. It's just the circle of life. You know, that there's no sense that we're stealing somebody else's thing.
No, it's the circle of life.
We're just next.
Yeah.
The Toltecs were here, and then the Hindus were here, and the Welsh. Which of them built these weird mounds? We don't know.
The Hindus.
So you can see why... Yeah.
This is Hindus with two O's.
That you can tell exactly how they're saying it, right? and I'm not saying this is good scholarship. But, and you'll see this by, the actual kind of the common folklore about these mounds was that they must have been built not just by vanished proto-Welshmen or proto-Hindus, but actually by giants.
Really?
Well, think about it. They're like 100 feet tall. who would wander the plains of the American bottom building something really tall? A very tall tribe.
But at the, okay, so we've talked about tall tribes before, right? Sure. You did a show on the...
Like in Patagonia,
yeah,
maybe?
The Patagonian super talls. But no one ever suggested that the Pyramid of Giza, the Great Pyramid of Giza, was built by a giant.
Just a normal sized building for a very tall man. To him, that's not even a pyramid. Like, to him, that's just a house.
Yeah, a place to put his raspberry beer, set his beer down. But so it's interesting that this kind of fantastical, I guess the Americas were too early to the first Europeans still a place where there might be giants or big lizards or whatever.
Yeah, they're eager to believe it, and the New York Times, you can find in 19th century newspapers cases of people digging up what they claim to be just massive human skeletons. Well, guess what we found in one of these mounds? A 9-foot skeleton.
Well, wait a minute. In the 1970s, I believe that there were Bigfoots up in Lake Forest Park.
In the 19th century, that stuff wasn't in Time Life books. Uh-huh. It was actually in the New York Times, you know, because it would just be a game of telephone coming from Ohio or whatever.
Right.
And by the time it got to the coast, it would be like, word reaches us from the Northwest Territories of Ohio that a 9-foot skeleton has been unearthed from the mounds near... I don't know where would it be? Yeah, exactly.
Interesting that in your cosmology, mid 19th century newspaper reporters are speaking in mid Atlantic radio broadcasters' accent.
That's how media people have always talked.
A big report from outside of
London. London. Let's give the Jerrys what for, shall we?
But it's true that at a certain point along the way, someone dug up a T-Rex skeleton. And that must have seemed just as, or maybe more incredible, and would have made it very plausible that you would also dig up a 9-foot tall man.
Yeah, and I don't know what they're actually seeing. Are they seeing a bunch of bones of extinct stuff and thinking, I mean, people knew about mammoths and whatnot by this time. People even knew about dinosaurs by this time. So I guess the idea was stuff used to be bigger. Why not people? And this was just the common knowledge. Like
comedy used to be funnier. Yeah,
you couldn't make Blazing Saddles today, John. Like you can even find Abraham Lincoln just kind of waxing poetic about it. Now, of course, we all he's a Midwestern guy,
also a tall guy.
And he's tall, so he probably feels an affinity for these.
I love these mountains.
Boy, if I'd lived back then, I would have. I'm 8 feet tall with my hat on. I would have certainly built something like this. You can find him talking about how at the same time as the great civilizations of Europe and the Middle East were rising and falling, he just takes it for granted that there were super tall people wandering the plains. He says, the eyes of that species of extinct giant whose bones fill the mounds of America have gazed on Niagara as our eyes do now. Doesn't it blow your mind that Niagara Falls was still rolling while they were building the pyramids and when the 9-foot giants of Ohio were... We're doing all their earth moving.
We're coming down across the enormous ice wall that protected us from the invading ghost peoples.
Yeah, exactly. That's we should have that kind of wall protecting us from Canada.
Yeah,
for sure.
Let's not get started.
Game of Thrones style ice wall to keep the Blue Jays fans out of Mariners games.
Stop antagonizing Canadian baseball fans.
So nobody ever. I mean, there were scattered cases where somebody would, Thomas Jefferson himself, I guess, did excavation on some newly discovered mound. Oh, boy,
And ran out there with his little pail and shovel.
I don't think he was in office. He didn't like leave the French ambassador to go do this. But at some point, and he led his own expedition and he was like, hey, this just looks like, burial stuff of Native American tribes. He was like, oh, this is just. Indian stuff is my theory.
This is just regular Indian stuff.
That's what he said. This is a little RIS. But that was not the popular theory. It must have been some lost mega civilization that we know nothing of. Because again, we've seen these scattered hunter-gatherer Indian tribes with their stone axes.
Right.
It's clearly not them. It's their predecessors.
But when we were discoveries were happening about in the Yucatan, there was also, at what point is it true that it was like a flourishing culture of such mega proportions that it's not, that it isn't really relative to what they had in front of them, the people that they knew around them.
Yeah, I think that was slow. I think the acceptance was pretty, and even today, I think that our idea in our culture is like, well, of course there were massive cities and infrastructure projects and armies and civilizations in Peru and in Mexico. But, you know, we don't imagine that kind of thing happening.
The Wakanda of Illinois.
Yeah. We don't imagine any kind of Wakanda in Illinois. Right. For whatever reason, they didn't venture that far up. And that's not entirely wrong. I mean, a lot of those big cultures did originate in the southern parts of the hemisphere. But we now know that there was a massive culture that we call the Mississippian, just because it thrived along the Mississippi River Valley thousands of years ago, hitting a peak around between, you know, 1000 and 1200 AD. For millennia, you know, there were... These areas were peopled by the ancestors of today's Native Americans. They were mostly hunter-gatherers, although some of them had learned to cultivate, you know, many tribes cultivated things like squash and sunflower. So that's the basis for your diet, I guess. If you're tired of deer, you have two vegetarian options.
Squash and sunflower.
Squash and sunflower.
Together, well, and you put it in a blender and you add a little bit of spinach and some raspberry beer, and you've got a smoothie.
They don't have spinach. Oh. They don't have raspberry beer.
Oh, bummer.
The problem with those ingredients, they are not squash or sunflower.
I see.
The two things we know were cultivated like 3,000 or 4,000 years ago on this continent.
They didn't have pumpkins? I thought pumpkins were...
I guess when I say squash, I'm including all the gourds.
Yeah, okay.
They had zucchini, if that helps.
What about maize? I mean, my people call it maize.
That's the thing. Maize had not yet...
Migrated
north from its original home in what is today Mexico and Central America. That didn't happen until the Little Ice Age of the, you know, the first millennium of this. It's not the first millennium of anything, if you're not Christian. Right. I was like, wait a second. The first millennium CE, I guess,
right.
Of the common era. AD. Got replaced by what we now call the medieval warming. Earth got a little warmer.
That's when that ice wall that protected us from Blue Jays fans finally melted.
And they were like, we can go without Tim Hortons for a couple days. Let's go menace the truck stops of Everett and Bothell on our way down to the ball game.
Right, in our American-made Winnebagos.
We do not understand the ball game, but we're going to be so drunk it won't matter.
We're going to get so many letters.
They're not sending their best, John. And so as it gets warmer, maize moves north. Your people call it maize.
Yes.
I say corn.
Sure.
I just found out that, you know, the blue and yellow of the University of Michigan, we had a listener write in offering us tickets to Michigan football games.
Who, you and me?
Yeah.
Where was I when that email came in?
You're not checking the email like usual.
I was just at Ohio State. I was in Columbus and went to the...
You saw the stadium? Or?
I went to the stadium. There wasn't a game at the time. But
so they wouldn't let you in.
So I thought about, you know, I thought about the Michigan-Ohio State rivalry. Another thing I'm thinking about as a potential omnibus topic.
I got good stuff about that.
The Michigan-Ohio State?
I mean, the Michigan stadium's even bigger. Can't you fit like 110,000 people in there?
It's enormous.
I think they call it the big house. Anyway, their colors, which I have always thought of as blue and yellow, the yellow is actually maize.
Oh.
That's...
And the blue is azure.
I don't want to get this wrong because I'm going to get. We'll hear from a bunch of happy Ohio State fans.
Yeah, if we get the Michigan story wrong,
is it? I think it's just maize and blue. They don't say maize and something.
Uh-huh.
I guess it goes back to 1860s when it was actually maize and azure blue.
Oh, so, hello.
So you know, often it's people in the stands wearing blue, but occasionally they'll do a maize out. And our correspondent says you got to be here for a maize out when everybody's wearing yellow. And I was just annoyed at the frequent repetition of the word maize.
Sure, maize out.
Stop saying maize out. Stop saying it.
Maisie Glotz, as my dad would say.
Mazzie Star. Wait, why would your dad say Maisie Glotz?
Maisie Glotz
My dad said Mersey Dotes.
Yeah, sure. My dad said Mersey Dotes too, because what the hell? We're Americans.
When he wasn't busy saying Maisie Glotz. No, you're saying that like that's true of everyone. We had the last dads that said Mersey Dotes.
I say Mersey Dotes.
Oh.
Well, and Dozy Dotes.
You're paying it forward.
Yeah, I say it when it's applicable. Yeah. No, Maisie Glotz was the name that my dad used for any, you know, to mean like any woman. he would say, oh, well, I was
like Jane
down there.
Doe?
Yeah, I was down there and talking to Maisie Glotz, and she told me that I couldn't.
We need to do a show about this. That's insane.
So Maisie Glotz is just my name for, yeah, it's like, it's Jane Doe.
Maisie right? Glotz sounds like it would be a euphemism for when you have your monthly visitor, you know, like, right. Oh, Maisie Glotz is here,
come to stay for a week.
That's crazy. If I look this up, do you think it's a thing or do you think your dad made it up?
I've never looked up Maisie Glotz. It just never occurred to me because it feels like the...
And Dozy Glotz?
I know Maisie Glotz as I know my own hand.
I think maybe I'm not going to stop the show to look up Maisie Glotz, but I kind of want to.
Yeah. Ken, Christmas is upon us. No. Halloween is upon us.
And
it's time to start thinking of Halloween gifts and Thanksgiving gifts for the people closest to you.
Are those the big gift giving occasions in your household? Halloween and Thanksgiving?
My daughter yesterday said that Halloween was her favorite holiday, even over her birthday, which has always been top of the pile.
Does she know her birthday is not a holiday?
She doesn't, no, and I'm not going to be the one that tells her, but, Halloween, she said it combines my two favorite things, candy and costumes.
No gifts.
No gifts.
I always, as a kid, I loved getting a stocking full of candy on Christmas, but that was just like an asterisk compared to a bunch of toys.
Massive bag of candy, though, that you get at Halloween.
It is a big bag.
I mean, her comment might be kind of casting a little shade on the Christmas present she gets, but that's dumb. She gets great Christmas presents. The point is that when you get to be an adult, you don't really get to avail yourself yourselves of a giant bag of candy. And you also, your Christmas presents kind of drop off in quality, right? You start getting pocket flashlights and, you know.
It's more like, what do you even get cards. Someone that age?
But what you can get for yourself and for your loved ones are omnibus t-shirts. Omnibus t-shirts are basically a way of signaling to the rest of the world that you are a cut above.
A person of taste, not just in podcasting, but in fashion, because these are good looking shirts. Have you seen the two latest ones?
Describe the shirts to me and use your most florid language.
I'm not.
You're not really a describer, are you?
I'm not really going to do Tim Gunn thing here.
It's got two sleeves and it's made of cotton.
They are the original designs from
back in the day,
earlier in the year, or even I can't remember last calendar year. The omnibus logo in kind of omnibus shelter, Fallout shelter yellow,
and yet
this is a twist on it. It's a sparkly gold that is very glam.
That is glam. I was always shy about wearing sparkle t-shirts until I got one, and then. All I want is sparkle t-shirts now.
And I don't think they're the kind where the glitter gets everywhere. Although, no. You know, I don't want to face a bunch of lawsuits if your glitter gets everywhere.
Right.
The other one is says Futurelings with...
That's the one you designed.
Yeah, I drew some various kinds of Futurelings. A tentacle and a robot hand and a lobster claw. And this one is that design, but glow in the dark.
The shirt glows in the dark.
If you have been looking for something to make you stand out on... Pirates of the Caribbean, or during
on the dance floor,
or during a blackout, or in the club,
right?
You know, really, all those places. What could be more appropriate than a slightly nerdy podcast by middle-aged men?
Maybe don't wear it to an astronomy telescope group.
If you're at like a dark sky event,
in
southern Utah. Or some isle off Scotland.
It might actually be fine. It's going to glow just enough that it's funny, but not enough to like...
To mess with the retina of your fellow astronomers.
You just put a sweater on.
The thing about those glow-in-the-dark shirts is they need some exposure to light.
Yeah.
So hide them in your closet before you get to the dark sky observation event.
Oh, I thought you were making a comment that nerds wouldn't see the sun.
You would never go outside.
Anyway, these shirts are awesome. They're available for a limited time, and we highly suggest that you order one of each for yourself and then for all of the people that you love in your
life.
Buy
one of each size because, you know, this pandemic's been going on for a while. You don't know how much weight you're going to gain or lose.
Right. And also, you never know if you're going to get a new significant other and they're going to show up and start stealing your omnibus shirt to wear as a sleep shirt. And you're like, wait a minute, like, that's mine. And then you should already have one in, in a smaller or larger size.
And you know that feeling when a favorite t-shirt finally starts getting a hole somewhere near the collar or under the armpit, and suddenly you don't have your favorite t-shirt anymore. So you might want to get 3 to 5 of each.
Depending on how punk rock you are.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. But do you want an omnibus t-shirt with a big hole? I guess it depends on where it is.
I gave a gift of a band t-shirt to a lady friend of mine recently, and the next time I saw her, she had cut the sleeves off of it and the collar out of it, and I had to confess, made it a cooler shirt.
Yeah, that's on the table. You can get several of these and deface them.
Cut the sleeves off, cut the collar out, and all of a sudden it's like an omnibus, kind of ripped, flash dancey, off the shoulder, cool kid shirt.
But do not remove the tag under penalty of law. If you want to see the new shirts and see that if they strike your fancy or any of the other merch we have available, you can always go to omnibusproject.com/store and enter code omnibus and get absolutely nothing. As Maze moves north, some of the wandering peoples from this part of, you know, from the beginnings of what we now call the Mississippian culture, because we don't know what they called themselves. They had no written language. Mm-hmm. So they hard for us to know their stories. But they discover that what we now call the American Bottom is super fertile because the Mississippi River just floods all the time.
All those little lakes.
Yeah, it's all the glacial stuff from when they melted.
Right.
And if you don't have oxen, and if you don't have steel plows, but you're going to farm for corn, you need good soil. You know, you need...
that black bottom.
You need that black bottom soil of the American bottom's black, apparently.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And so this becomes a real center of... their community. And around 700 to 1000 AD, they found a city there, the same one that the monks later found, later discovered the remaining earthworks from. They did not call it Cahokia. That's like a later descendant of some Illini people that the early Europeans found there. So they were like, yeah, this is the, you know, from the Cahokia people. But it's not Cahokia at all.
In the absence of a written language, how do we know what they called it?
Exactly.
I see.
Maybe they called it nothing.
Sure. I bet you they didn't call it nothing. You had to say, I'm here, I'm going there.
I'm going to the big city.
Going to the city. I'm going to town.
Going downtown. And it literally was a city. The funny thing about this, because we do not imagine a Wakanda in southern Illinois, of all places, in 1000 AD.
There certainly isn't one there now.
You're not counting East St. Louis?
It's not the place that we as Americans chose to build our temple.
But there are the estimates of what the population of the city might have been. You know, now that we've kind of studied the 120 plus mounds there and tried to get a sense of what the city would have looked like then by virtue of just archaeological finds.
The 120 mounds they're not just widely dispersed. Because as you drive through Ohio and all these, you know, there's always some sign that says like,
come see our mound.
Yeah, there's a mound over here. There's a mound over there. But you're saying that these mounds are all part of one big construction.
It's a complex.
Wow.
And what's more, the more it's studied, the more method there seems to be to what the monks would have just thought of as some random bumps.
Random bumps
in your American bottom.
I keep going to the dermatologist and they're like, it's nothing.
For example, it all seems to be on a grid.
What, really?
Yeah. The grid is like, it's the stuff you would, you know, be mildly interested about if you heard it from a Toltec or an Aztec or a Mayan city, but the fact that it's in southern Illinois, you're like, wait, what?
Yeah.
Well, it's like 6 square miles.
Oh.
It's a grid.
Oh.
It's tilted, I think, 5 degrees east of north, which seems to be...
what is magnetic north in that area?
Well, it seems to have astronomical significance. Okay. Like that tends to accord with maybe something related to the solstice or where the moon rises at the equinoxes. You know, like there seems to be maybe some astronomical reasons why you would orient your stuff 5 degrees east of north.
And could also be a prank.
like, or just shoddy work by the first guy. So which way is north? It's more or less that hill.
See the tree up there?
Let's just say it's the tree. It's more over there, but there's no tree.
Yeah.
There are, it was heavily wooded, right, by the way. Right. So, because we know that they, there's signs of all the wood they use. In fact, this, the reason why we know about their astronomical know-how is because there are a series of circles of where wooden poles had been placed, vast circles, not too different from the...
Oh, tree henge.
The henges, yeah. They call it wood henge now. There are wood henge 1 through 5, five different massive circles of poles.
I've been to a couple of the wood henges.
In the US or in the UK?
In the UK.
Yeah, the UK has a wood... The funny thing is it's all... There's no such thing as a henge. It's a back formation from Stonehenge.
Oh.
But now they're like, okay, we got other henges. Henge is not really a word.
It is now.
It is now.
There's, waka waka.
There's Manhattan Henge.
So you're saying that this...
go ahead.
These cities were made of wood. And so unlike the great stone constructions that survive thousands of years, the reason we only see the mounds is that the everything else
didn't last.
Wow. Okay.
But they were somehow doing these massive earthworks. And... It now appears they built these mounds pretty quickly. Like, even though they're like 100 feet tall and they had to move earth and clay with nothing more than stone axes and woven baskets, that they were built, I mean, when I say quickly, I mean over a matter of decades. But, right, you know, faster than a cathedral.
Right.
In if we're talking about what's going on in Europe at the same time. And in some cases, what, 55 million cubic feet of dirt in the larger mounds?
Hmm.
So, you know, a big project to tackle.
Are they hollow?
Yes.
Are they filled with cream?
No, you're thinking of the Cahokia Almond Joy, which has a nut in it. These are the Cahokia mounds. It's all coconut.
Well, the thing is, the Almond Joy has nuts, but the mounds don't.
Yes, it's just coconut under there all the way down. The funny thing about the circles is that they found a few poles, or what appear to be post holes, evidence of post holes. And they thought, wow, these things are pretty deep. There was something big here. And they started to plot the arc. And, you know, I think a decade went by and somebody was like, well, what if it's a full circle? And they start digging somewhere else very far away. And they're like, nope, here they are again.
Well,
as predicted, you know, kind of like finding Uranus or Neptune from their orbits, they could find the rest of the circle. And
how big was the circle?
All five of the wood henges have different diameters, ranging from 240 feet across to 450 feet across. And... they also seem to be aligned with, you know, for example, where the sun would set or rise on certain astronomically significant days of the year, solstices and equinox and so forth.
So this whole area is in what what would now be called suburban St. Louis, eastern St. Louis, Illinois side of St. Louis.
Yeah, and I drove through East St. Louis on my way to Carbondale, and I wish I had stopped because I was no more than a few miles from the mounds, which are now just outside Collinsville, Illinois. And it's now like a, you know, one of the most visited, you know, state parks in Illinois. It's a historic site, and now it's a UNESCO, it's a National Historic Landmark and a UNESCO site.
It's also the site of the world's largest ketchup bottle.
Collinsville?
Yeah.
I thought, you know, because the St. Louis airport goes to great lengths to tell you they have the tallest monument and the biggest zoo.
Oh, yeah.
But nobody mentions if you just cross, maybe because you have to cross a state line, but nobody mentions the biggest ketchup bottle.
The biggest ketchup bottle. It's on the Illinois side.
Could you fit it through the arch? Could you deflower the St. Louis arch with the
bet you could.
With Illinois' biggest ketchup bottle?
You missed going to Frederick's Music Lounge, although I think it might be closed. I'll clue you in the next time you're headed there.
Have you played in Collinsville, Illinois?
No, Frederick's Music Lounge, I'm sorry.
Oh, in St. Louis.
It's in St. Louis. Oh, okay.
Yeah. That would be amazing if you had done the Rawhide theme in some little redneck bar in Collinsville, Illinois.
Rawhide.
So we know these people had big mounds and advanced.
We've got astronomical
advanced astronomical knowledge. There is, you know, even though the wood is gone, you can. It's like Sutton Hoo. You can see traces of where it was, and so we now know there were like big buildings atop the mound. So these would rise above the city.
Wow, okay.
It would be like the Acropolis or whatever, except they had to build their own because they didn't, you know, Cahokia, whatever the city was called, did not come with its own mountain. So it was probably like a ritual space that the wealthy, that there was a, you know, apparently a caste system. So the chiefs, the powerful people would have lived up there. There was a ritual space for whatever their religious practices were.
So the mounds are not,
The mounds are not the footprint of the city.
But the mounds are not themselves the thing. They were the foundation of structures.
They were built so that the gods or the wealthy or the chiefs or whoever it was could literally look down on the rest of this fairly vast city.
Is that true of all the other Midwestern mounds, the snake-shaped mounds and all that? Or are they now believed to have been the foundations of buildings?
Maybe. I mean, the thing you'll see here is that, you know, as Skokie actually started to be studied through the 20th century, it was kind of thought of as an anomaly, you know, essentially a Wakanda, you know. Uh-huh. We know the rest of these tribes were just, you know, spearing buffalo and having a good time.
Sure.
These guys built a crazy city. And I think the academic consensus is now moving toward the fact that Skokie is not really out of line, that with the Mississippian culture and other native cultures of the Americas, that they did live together in cities and communities, and at times big cities formed and other times they didn't. So it's just not that unusual. We just don't, you know, we have this maybe kind of a romantic view of, well, they were so in harmony with nature. Obviously they just lived in little lean-tos in the forest, when in fact, you know, these mounds would have been surrounded by, you know, plazas where we know from what we found there that merchants and artisans were making pottery and fashioning plows and other things to sell. The amazing thing is there's traces of copper that we know comes from Lake Superior. We can see they were bartering with shells that have come from the Gulf of Mexico.
Oh, okay. So a trade culture.
All the way up the river, yeah. Flint and chert from Oklahoma, mica from the Carolinas. It's a Native American culture that's just taking advantage of the mineral resources to produce tools and art, and that's not something we imagine from 1080.
Any irrigation canal works?
I mean, no.
All that probably got swamped away by the river, too.
There doesn't appear to be any kind of sanitation system, and this plays into later theories about, you know, now that we know what Cahokia was and how remarkable it was, you know, the next question historians want to answer is, where did it go? Because, of course, we have to be careful estimating population, but it sure seems like around the year 1200, there were over 10,000 people there, maybe more, maybe 20,000, maybe 50,000. This would make Cahokia bigger than London or Paris in the 11th and 12th centuries. And that has as much to do with, you know, London going through a rough time post-Romans than it does to do with how well Cahokia was doing.
Well,
but both things happened at once.
Even without a sewer system, Cahokia could not have smelled any worse than London in 1000 AD.
Right. So what, you know, what happened to them? You know, like, I think in the 90s, there was a pretty well-accepted theory that it must have been deforestation. We see evidence that these people used lots of wood. Once the wood was used up, you're going to get more flooding. I guess, you know, Tree roots pull a lot of water out of the soil. You know, treeless plains get waterlogged faster. They don't absorb as much water, so you get runoff, so you get flooding.
100-year flood, 1,000-year flood, one of them could have wiped it out.
Right. So the assumption was, well, they deforested everything, and then it just started flooding all the time, and they were like, look, Cahokia is just not for us. Turns out we're going to move back to my mom in Henderson, Nevada, or whatever. You know, people flee the cities, I guess, just as is happening today. But there's been some new research just from the last few years, one study in 2018 and one in 2021. The recent one from this April could not find any evidence of flooding at all.
Oh.
You know, you'd think you'd see the yearly alluvial deposits or whatever, or, you know, from the flooding, and there's just not there. So, you know, maybe although they had a lot of wood, maybe they just did a better job than we do at not using up the resource they had. There was another study from 2018 that, I guess you can, one way to find human habitation in strata of dirt is to look for coprostantol, a chemical that's found in human poop. You can tell how many people have been pooping at a place over time.
But if they're all pooping in a poop hole, you're not going to find it just like spread evenly around.
I don't know. Maybe it eventually spreads. There's, you know, it rains and there's groundwater and the coprostantol gets into it.
I suppose so. What are the coprostantol rates there?
The coprostantol findings are just surprising because it shows that far from being deserted around, you know, 1300, like I think people would have assumed about the Cahokia Mounds, in fact, it stayed a dwelling place for local tribes throughout the centuries. You know, it wasn't abandoned. It just became less densely populated.
Yeah, more a local spot.
And why is that? Like, there's evidence of, you know, wooden palisades, you know, like stockades, like built to defend it.
Right.
So it could have been war.
Sure.
It could have been invaded or
as so often abandoned. Is the case, war.
Oh, boy.
What is it good for?
Just
absolutely not.
It just makes you think about
it does
about right. man's inhumanity to man.
Right.
The lack of sanitation facilities really leaves it open to the possibility that it was a dysentery or tuberculosis or something that wiped it out.
I mean, the amazing thing about a city on an enormous river is that you can just go poop in the river.
That's what I would do.
It ends up being somebody else's problem.
It gets eaten by the devil serpent of New Orleans or
that's
whatever.
Right.
It could have been famine because you can imagine if you've got 15,000 people or whatever it is living right there, like how many deer are there going to be?
Well, you're all eating sunflowers and gourds.
Are there enough gourds and sunflowers for all? It's hard to say. One thing that may have happened is around 1300 AD, we have the first evidence that bison crossed the Mississippi River.
Oh.
And apparently they headed west like the pioneers after them.
Wait, you're saying that the bison were native to east of the Mississippi and they weren't yet on the Great Plains until 1300?
No, you're right. They arrived from the west.
So they crossed
they're
the
crossing
river,
the Mississippi east.
Headed east.
Yeah.
That's what you don't want bison in Chicago.
They were interested in show business. Mm. They were heading for
the bright lights.
They were heading for the bright lights of Broadway. They were heading for Buffalo, maybe. They were shuffling off. And, you know, there may have been, you know, if the Cahokia area suddenly starts to get touched by buffalo herds,
right?
Then suddenly the idea might be, hey, this is good eating.
Let's follow these buffaloes.
Yeah, let's just see where these guys are coming from and we can live a good life on the plains.
Right.
So maybe the people of Cahokia got siphoned off west.
They looked at their gourds and they were like, oh, man.
I mean, what are you even doing with the sunflowers? It's hard to imagine. You're just smashing the seeds into a kind of paste?
Yeah, delicious sunflower paste, oil, you know.
Because if you've ever put that on a sandwich because you have a peanut allergy, you know it's not great.
Sunflower.
Even today with all the
butter,
the salt and other stuff we put into it, mashed up sunflower on, you know, as a snack?
Yeah.
It's not the best. You can see why corn would be very tempting to these people. I've noticed on... I was on the plane the other day, and instead of giving out Cheetos, they were giving out Pitos, which are a healthier version of Cheetos made from legumes.
No thanks.
And I just thought, you know what? We have maize now. We don't have to eat Pitos anymore.
Keep your Pitos, is what I say.
Can they be sued by Cheetos? I don't think they should be allowed to just...
Everything's an O's.
You think there's prior art? Fritos, Doritos, Cheetos?
Yeah.
Somebody owns that. Frito-Lay, maybe.
Well, no, we've talked about the invention of the Dorito.
Does Frito-Lay make Pitos? Who makes Pitos?
Maybe Frito-Lay. Anything that you say Edo, Frito comes in.
They own Lance Edo, for example.
Uh-huh.
No, Pitos
that explains
is a,
it.
Pitos is an up-and-coming Frito-Lay rival. But I don't think Frito-Lay has anything to worry about. Because they had the genius idea to not make their chips out of peas.
Is there any precedent for a people that had formed a city, like a town building people, choosing to become nomadic.
Just bailing.
Because there's a new food source that arrives and they're like, you know what? Like this whole stay in the same house all the time thing is kind of dull compared to like eating big fat steaks every night.
Yeah, we always assume that cities are just so efficient or so alluring in some way that once you have Londinium,
yeah,
you don't go. How, you know, how are you going to keep them down on the farm?
Right. Why would you pick up and head out?
But imagine a world where Surrey is just full of buffalo, as far as the eye can see, and you know, you hunt for a week and then you can eat well all winter. Maybe people would be like, you know what? London's not for me. Like,
yeah, you do think of the quote unquote march of civilization as one that always trends toward greater domesticity.
We also don't know how good life was there. I mean, there's a right in front of in the main plaza, there seems to be a chunky court.
Go on.
Have you ever been arraigned in chunky court?
Is it chunk? What do you mean chunky court?
Chunky is the name of a Native American sport whose descendants we still see today. You roll some kind of a stone disc along the court and then try to throw a spear where it's going to land.
Oh.
So it's a more exciting version of bocce, I guess, because it's got spears. And second of all, you know, the item is still moving when you try to do the locating part of the game.
Yeah, a hunting facsimile.
Yeah, it's a stand-in for hunting. But they've also been discovered, they've got pro sports. They got a pro sports franchise.
Right on.
But they also have, we've also discovered mass graves of young people.
Oh.
With no sign of disease on their bones, but maybe some evidence of strangling, and some of them have had their hands and heads cut off. Even the worst archaeologists will notice immediately.
If a skeleton has had its
hands and head cut off. And this is often what you find in cultures that have human sacrifice of some kind. You know, a bunch of young people don't just all die together. They're also like...
Unless they had fraternity parties.
Well, yeah. I mean, in this case, there's other graves where there's evidence that the skeletons tried to dig out. So that would have been a heck of a party.
That's a terrible story.
So, you know, we don't know much about the religious beliefs of whoever lived in Cahokia when it was not mounds, but, you know, downtown. But it seems like it wasn't great for everyone.
Right. I think that's true of every civilization. I mean, you know, building all those mounds, you have to assume that most of the laborers probably were not like well paid, and like they probably weren't contract labor. They were probably pressed into service.
Is there a future for our cities where, I mean, I guess we're using metal and masonry now, but you know, we're talking to people 1,000 years hence. That will have all crumbled.
The concrete will have crumbled. The metal will have rusted.
Not fully away.
The glass?
You know, the metal in Sutton Hoo is looking pretty, it's in pretty bad shape.
Yeah.
Like it's just.
Yeah.
You'd have a hard time identifying it as metal, honestly.
What's interesting is that the peat bogs that preserve things so, you know, anaerobically in Northern Europe, that there wouldn't be any peat bogs in this region. It feels very peaty.
What a shame.
And that there wouldn't be eventually some discovery of things preserved, you know, like things that hadn't decayed completely. You only hope, right?
Yeah, sunflower leavings.
Yeah, who knows?
Empty squash.
I mean, all you would have to find is one warrior who fell into a peat hole to know
what they wore
1,000 times more than what we know now.
I wonder if, but I was thinking about like what our future listeners will like. Is it possible they will find our earthworks when, you know, the metal is crumbled and the masonry is dust? I guess the plastic will still be there. So they'll find big earthworks, you know, they'll find foundations and stuff.
Yeah.
You know, square-shaped holes and square-shaped rises, but just what littered with chip clips and hair barrettes.
We've done so much terraforming. You know, I think it's going to be, no matter how much it all falls apart.
You can see it you can see right angles from space now, right? You know, the Duwamish River here in Seattle, you know, aliens could, from a very high orbit, be like, even if we were all gone, they would be like, well, this has been inhabited.
Even if it washes out, right? All the places that we've cut and covered, all of the interstate highways that...
I feel like Mount Rushmore would be very hard to consider a natural formation.
Yeah, right.
Boy, what are the odds?
All it takes is one nose to survive, and it'll still pose a lot of questions.
I mean, we've seen the old man of the mountain, but what are the odds there'd be four old men on the mountain?
Also, you've got Crazy Horse sitting, 20 miles away. So
again, what are the odds?
Yeah.
That's real, real irony, geological irony.
And that concludes the Cahokia Mounds, entry 173.IS2502, certificate number 34924 in the omnibus. Futurelings, in the unlikely event that anything from our civilization survives well enough for people to understand, or for futurelings, rather, to understand what possibly could have comprised our civilization, or why we built all these dumb sports stadiums. What the hell games were we playing?
Chunky.
How are futurelings going to understand baseball? Imagine, I don't understand it now.
Imagine how wrong they will have been about so many things, you know, about these, their distant Cahokia-style ancestors, until they discover the omnibus.
Right.
And they're going to be delighted.
They'll be like,
at the new knowledge.
We thought the Beatles were warriors, but it turns out they were just sing-songers. They're going to have to consult the Canadians to figure out how baseball is played.
The Canadians don't know.
You futurelings will, as you start to uncover our civilization, absolutely want to go check out Ken's and my heyday of super good tweets and other social media posts starting in 2010 and going until, what would you say, 6 months ago? at Ken Jennings and at John Roderick. You can email us at theomnibusproject@gmail.com. You can support our show, even from the mists of the future, by going to patreon.com/omnibusproject and becoming a patron of the show. And as a patron, you will acquire all kinds of special powers. You'll be able to clairvoyantly speak to the dead.
You'll join the Time Variance Authority and be able to snip off renegade timelines that God does not approve of.
That's right. That's right. You'll have access to the predictive technology of detectives that live in ponds and can see crimes right before they happen.
We send an ice cream truck to your house. We actually, you know, the perks are pretty good.
Yeah, they are. In fact, we often talk about how we've given away too much. The perks are too good.
We're too generous.
Yeah. So get in on it now before we have to
tighten the clamp.
Before we get all stingy.
We want to thank James, who is the washing bear donor, who gave so devotedly that he got to suggest a topic for today's show, and among the topics he sent over was the Cahokia Mounds, which I thought was pretty good.
Well done, James. And you were just there, and I was just there.
What are the odds?
Pretty good, given the amount that we travel. And
the amount that we drive across Southern Illinois.
Yeah. What do you got there? Seems like you're... I had more spiel. So anyway, go to patreon.com/omnibus and become a patron of the show.
I'm opening the mail, which explains the noise.
Right. You can hang out with other futurelings, both in your future time at temples dedicated to Ken and myself, but in our present time, you can find futurelings congregating on all social media sites.
It's a virtual mound. You don't have to move 55 million square feet of Earth. You just have to go to Facebook.
Just go to
it's worse.
Facebook actually. Or other places, right? Depending.
There's a subreddit,
And you can mail us things. And I've sort of given away the ghost here by talking about you over there ripping up these envelopes.
But that famous saying we all know, giving away the ghost.
I gave away the ghost. Ken is opening the mail, and it came to us at P.O. Box 55744, Shoreline, Washington, 98155. So finally, Ken, what is in the mail?
I opened the big box first in classic Christmas style, and I'm very excited to see that the return address here is the Office of the Governor, 700 Capitol Avenue. Guess what state capital?
Kentucky.
Frankfort, Kentucky.
Is it really?
What has Governor Beshear sent us?
How did I guess that?
Governor Beshear has sent us signed certificates honoring us as commissioned Kentucky colonels.
Yay! Look at that. That's going right up on the omnibus bunker wall, unless you want to put it in your
we got two
trophy case. Let me see mine.
Thank you, Governor, for sending that over, or whoever at the state is in charge of getting him to sign the colonel commissions.
Honorable Kenneth Wayne Jennings III.
Yeah, that font is not great for the three I's.
No, it looks like backwards P's, but it's pretty good. And then I didn't even get a middle name on mine, but that's all right.
It could have gone to your Wikipedia.
That's all right. These actually seem, Ken, these have been...
You don't think it's an auto sign, or what do you call the auto pen?
I think that at least the Secretary of State Michael G. Adams has signed this with his own hand. I wonder if either Andy...
Is Governor Beshear a little busy trying to get people to mask up at the Rite Aid?
I feel like the governor's signature
at the Winn-Dixie
may have been affixed here. Ugh. It's pre-printed, but Michael Adams used two separate pens for our different.
It's probably like the bill signing thing where he gave one pen away to one group of needy children and the other to another group.
Oh well, those are beautiful. I'm so glad that that we are enshrined.
Thank you, Zach, for sending that over. I don't know if you do that as part of your job or if you're just a listener to the show who has an in at the Secretary of State's office, but that's a lovely gesture.
He seems like a graphic artist, Zach Pencil.
We also got something from Australia, which I'm very excited. I opened this one first because they paid a ton of money to get this to us. And, you know, when you send things internationally, Lucy sent us this from Braddon, Australia.
Uh-huh.
Wait, is that right? ACT, isn't that the Australian Capital Territory? Isn't that like Canberra?
Did she have to pay VAT tax on it? Oh, no. She has to pay VAT tax if she buys one of our t-shirts.
It's the Southern Hemisphere. They have TAV tax. Uh-huh. But the thing about these customs forms is you have to give away what you're sending. So this kind of gives away. There's spoilers on the outside. I know this is going to contain documents, stickers, and a pin badge.
Okay.
She went to great effort to send this all the way from. We would like to offer you joint honorary lifetime membership to the recently formed International Astronological Society.
Astronological.
This is a small gesture of thanks for making Omnibus and filling up the airwaves or thousands of human heads with interesting facts, scientific and otherwise. Your official membership pack is enclosed. We have membership number 11.
We have a joint membership.
Yeah, apparently from Lucy and Johnny. What is the Astronological Society?
We're the 11th members of the Astronological Society.
We are jointly the 11th member. So if the other members are each 30 people, you know, maybe we're in the first 100. We get a little document certifying that we belong to the world's independent scientific society dedicated to the promotion of logical thinking around celestial phenomena. Oh, here we go. And has renounced their star sign. It's an anti-astrology group that has tracked us down.
What is your star sign, Ken?
I have to renounce it. I cannot tell you.
Oh.
I mean, you can probably figure it out in two Google searches or less. One if you're good at star signs.
Let's see if I Google what is Ken Jennings' star sign.
I'll have to give up my little pen they sent that says I don't have a star sign. And then these stickers from Lucy and Johnny. Here's one that says astronological.org, so you can check that out if you're extremely anti-horoscope.
I found it, but I'm not going to say it.
That's good. They would be extremely angry at me in Canberra.
It just threw it right up, though. All you have to do is say, what is Ken Jennings, a star sign? I don't think I'm famous enough that this thing is going to answer that question for me, but I'm going to ask it anyway, well, just to see.
I'm sure it's easy to program into Google. I don't understand the stickers that come with it. There's a telescope, which I understand. Oh, I see. It's a crab.
Oh, wait, it does. All you do is say, what is John Roderick's star sign? And there it is, kapow.
Don't say.
Well, kapow isn't a star sign.
Oh, you're not kapow Mercury rising?
No.
I'm on the cusp of kapow and boyoyoyoying.
So is astronological...
Is this your star sign?
That's pretty good.
I think this is mine. The stickers are kind of fun, but are we supposed to not have these? Are we supposed to burn these now that we have them?
No, they're ironical.
We also get stickers of people looking in telescopes, I guess, to promote real astronomy.
Yeah.
But then they also sent us cute stickers of our star signs, which is a little confusing messaging.
Astronological is not a
word?
Is not a word, right? Or I mean, it is the no in there emphasized?
My guess is they're taking astronomical
and
putting in logical to show how that
they are both astronomical and lovable.
Well, my guess is to show that astrology flies in the face of logic. They want to emphasize the logicalness of their beliefs.
Well, on behalf of one half of our membership,
10 and a half,
I'm going to say right on. High five.
Are you 10 to 10.5 and I'm 10.51 to 11 as far as our membership number?
Yeah, all right. I'm 10.5.
Or do you think it starts at 11 and goes to 12?
Oh, that's a good question. No, I would say 11 to 12. 11 to 12.
I'm also terrified that I'm saying Canberra wrong, and I'm going to hear from Australians on this. Because they're still mad that we're not saying Melbourne.
Mm.
Melbourne.
Melbourne.
Is it?
There's an R in it.
Well, no, not for them. I mean, there's a
Melbourne.
And none of them can read and write, so they don't
Canberra.
Know. They don't know there's an R in it. Canberra. Canberra.
Canberra.
Canberra.
Aluminium.
Canberra.
How did you say it?
I think I said Canberra.
Canberra.
As in, like, my husband left me and I Canberra.
Uh-huh.
Listeners, from our vantage point in your distant past, we have no idea how long our civilization survived. We hope and pray that the catastrophe we fear may never come. If the worst comes soon, this recording, like all our recordings, may be our final word. But if Providence allows, we hope to be back with you soon for another entry in the Omnibus.